The following message is brought to you by Terry Moore. And now, Mr. Moore.
A couple of announcements. So the first announcement is that we had published a new booklet this week. It is available on our website to read and to download. It is titled, The Trinity, Fact or Fiction? And we are currently taking orders for that, for those people who would like a printed copy, and those printed copies should be available sometime next week, and we'll have some here at services next week for those who are interested. I would like to thank those people who were involved with producing that booklet, chiefly God, the Father, and Jesus Christ. Also, I want to thank my partner in this branch of God's work, Art Bradick, for his efforts in that publication, as well as those people that reviewed and gave some input. Carl Hellyer, he reviewed it, did a bit of editing and gave some input, as well as William Blank, and we appreciate their efforts as well. And, of course, Jamie Fox, who did some work on the graphic for the cover. She's done some work for several of our booklet covers, and we appreciate everybody's participation in that. The next booklet we will be working on is mostly written. It's been actually mostly written for some time, and we just... one of those things that keeps getting pushed to the back burner, and but we are going to be publishing a book about the gift of music. God is the one who created music, and there are so many positive and valuable things that can be gained from music, but also this booklet will be talking about the abuse of music, which is something that I think the church has tended to focus on over the years. And so it was my intent when we began working on this project to put together something that showed the great benefits that music has as well. And so I can't give anybody a timeline as when that will be published, because so many things need to get taken care of and things get pushed back a bit, but we are, that is in the works, and hopefully it won't take too long to get that published. I would like to repeat an announcement that was made last week. Maybe it was the week before. I don't recall. But in any case, we are still in need of people who can help us to establish and maintain media accounts on a variety of social platforms. I manage the YouTube platform as well as Facebook and Rumble. And we would like to expand this to include a handful of other platforms that we had reviewed. I took some time, and there are more than 20 other media platforms that can be utilized. So many people are getting information from these platforms, and I think it would be helpful to use them as a way to preach the gospel. And it doesn't take a whole lot of effort. And we would like to do that, but it's just we find it hard to add more things to the list, right? You know, we're limited in financially, but we're also limited in manpower. So if anybody is interested in helping us with that, please contact us and we'll see what can be done. Let's go over to Ecclesiastes chapter 9 today for the sermon, the book of Ecclesiastes, and in chapter 9. There is a growing struggle among most today in a world that is declining morally at an increasing rate. The values that many of the Western nations have long held in high regard are being disregarded in the name of love or inclusion. What most do not realize is that the kind of love that they want to express, that they feel like they want others to have for one another, is actually a love of evil. It's a love of, and it's been inspired by demonic forces. This is the leading decline of civilization, because there is no longer a stable ethic in most societies today, a stability of the fabric of our society. And in turn, many other things are declining. People's health is declining. The economy is declining. Our military strength is declining. And we even see that recently, the current administration is, in my opinion, it seems even too weak to take out a Chinese surveillance vehicle that is currently roaming the U.S. atmosphere in high altitudes, and we won't do anything about it. And that, But we won't get into that. I saw a short program this past week discussing increasing chronic illness among kids, adolescents, and teenagers. And this brief program, it was only about, I think it was about 10 minutes long that I had watched, it indicated that roughly 45% of school-age children are suffering from some form of chronic physical and or mental condition. Those are huge numbers for a population that should be healthy, that should be vibrant. And of course, one of the things that they only briefly mentioned, but I think a lot of this mental illness can be directly related to physical health and the environment that people, that these kids are being raised in. In addition, 60% of adults have a chronic illness today, and 40% have two or more chronic illnesses. The last poll taken, which was about 6 months ago, showed that 64% of Americans are living paycheck to paycheck. That's huge. That means that the majority of the country has no safety net of savings if some emergency were to arise. And those numbers are not limited to people outside of the Church of God. Most of us find ourselves among that 64%. And many of us are dealing with some kind of illness, possibly a chronic illness. Now, there might be a variety of reasons that problems among us are found today. I understand that. To some degree, we do experience time and chance. And this is noted by Solomon after all of the knowledge that he had gained, and much of this was turned to wisdom, not all, of course, but something he had written in Ecclesiastes 9 and verse 11, where he said, I returned and saw under the sun, just meaning on this planet, that the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong. Sometimes the swift don't win. Sometimes the battle isn't won by those who are strong. Nor bread to the wise, nor riches to men of understanding, nor favor to men of skill. But time and chance happens to them all. And so we understand there is this element of time of chance, time and chance, or we might call circumstance, where we can become victim to circumstance, situations sometimes that are out of our control. However, the race can go to the swift, and the battle can be won by the strong, and favor given to people who are skilled when we are preparing to run. When we are trying to be strong, when we are seeking knowledge and seeking to be wise, that offers great benefit. And that is why Solomon wrote in the previous verse, I know sometimes people read that, but they don't consider the previous verse, verse 10, where he said that whatever your hand finds to do, do it with your might, with your strength, do it sincerely. For there is no work or device or knowledge or wisdom in the grave where you are going. Yeah, we're all going there one day. We're all going to die one day. Even if we don't die before Christ returns, our physical body is going to perish if we happen to be one of the few chosen and we rise to meet him in the air. So now is our opportunity. Now is our moment in time to show God and to be a witness to others of the quality that we have or that we would like to have. Work toward it. Do it with all our strength, because there's no second opportunity for those who are called for the first chance, the first resurrection as it is. And so this truth goes hand in hand. It's a good scripture if you don't have it already next to Ecclesiastes 9:10 is to have Colossians 3:23, something the Apostle Paul had written where he said, whatever you do, do it heartily. And he doesn't just mean robustly, although that could be an application. What he's talking about is doing it wholeheartedly. with all your strength. And then he adds, as to the Lord, and not just to men. As to Lord, you know, whatever we put our hand to do, do it with the kind of commitment that we should have as to the Lord. Meaning doing it with integrity, doing it with resolve, having endurance, you know, doing the best job that we can and with the mindset that we are going to do this, we are going to finish the mission. Now, the reason Paul had written that encouragement in Colossians 3:23 is because God does not let his favored people experience more than they can handle. He wants for us to be prepared. He's not going to just pave the path for us and make it everything easy, but he's telling us, look, work at it, prepare for it, you can do it, and I'll be with you in the process. And so for this reason, Paul had said something else in 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 13. He said that no temptation or trial has overtaken you except that which is common to man. We experience the same things many people of the world experience. But God is faithful and will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able to bear, but with the temptation will also make the way of escape. Not just taking you out of it so you don't have to experience it, because he adds that you may be able to bear it. Help us get through it. To learn a lesson. And sometimes that lesson is something we need to learn. We've all heard the expression, whether from our parents or from another place, you need to learn your lesson. Because we mess up sometimes, don't we? We make mistakes. Sometimes those mistakes are intentional. And so let's go over to 1 Peter 5. When there are situations that are difficult, whether it's physically or perhaps they're mentally challenging or straining, God is going to make a way for us to be able to get through it. But there's something that we need to consider. It's not all just time and chance. It's not just sometimes we have put ourselves in that situation, don't we? Sometimes we place ourselves in that circumstance. And so something that many people do not consider, and I'm talking about Church of God, I'm talking about believers, something that people I think do not consider enough is that there is a possibility why we are facing trials. And it could be that you and I might be lacking in some of the qualities that God favors, that he wants for us to have. So how often do we ask ourselves, you know, when we're faced with a situation that's difficult, how often do we reflect and say, you know, is there something that we are doing that we should not be doing? Or maybe there's something that we're not doing that we should be doing. It's a legitimate question. And I think many people in the Church of God are not asking themselves this question enough. The Apostle Peter had written in 1 Peter 5 and verse 8, he said to be sober. And he's not talking about refraining from alcohol. We're allowed to have alcohol in moderation. But be sober, meaning having self-control, temperate. Be vigilant, that is watchful, careful with our behavior. Why? Because your adversary, the devil, walks about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. And that is something that people just don't, you know, now I'm talking outside the Church of God, people don't believe in the devil. Therefore, they don't believe in God. They don't know that their supposed love and inclusion is something that is inspired by demonic forces. They say, no, those things don't exist, and therefore, God doesn't exist. And if God doesn't exist, morality doesn't exist, and it's just a free-for-all. And that's where we're headed right now. But here, Peter is talking to people in the church, saying to have self-control, to be watchful of your behavior, because the devil walks about like a roaring lion. Resist him, he says in verse 9. Resist him steadfast in the faith. That's how we resist. being faithful. Knowing that the same sufferings or the same afflictions, the same hardships that you and I experience by your brotherhood are experienced by your brotherhood in the world. And so there is this element of time and chance. The same, we face a lot of the same problems and difficulties and challenges that people in the world do. But some might use this. Don't misuse it. Some might use it as an excuse away our troubles and be like, oh, well, it's not, you know, everybody else goes through this type of thing. And we might not think that, you know, hey, maybe there's something else. Maybe there's something I should be doing that I'm not. So when we face trials, we all face them. Probably many of us are facing them right now. It's a good idea to consider, you know, are we truly resisting iniquity? Are we steadfast in the faith, as Peter said? Perhaps we're resisting God instead of the devil. Maybe our old ways, maybe the ways of this world, things that we're familiar with. Maybe those things are alluring to us, and it might cause us to compromise. Not do it, not put our hand to the plow, not do it, you know, be committed to God wholeheartedly. As Paul said in Colossians 3, heartily. And so the ways of this world might have an appeal to us. Let's be honest. They were or they are alluring. It should be of no surprise that they're attractive to this tainted human nature. I mean, all of us have this nature that is common to mankind. And so if many of our sins were not enjoyable, nobody would be doing them. We would live in a much better place. But they do have a degree of pleasure, of enjoyment. Sin is appealing to our pride. It's appealing to the eyes and to the flesh. It pleases one or more of the five senses. And we're human. Yeah, we're human. We have those senses. We can't deny them, but we can deny sin. That is something we can do. So you and I, we have had our moments of compromise. Let's be honest. We've been there. We've done that. We've compromised righteous standards at times. We have sinned. Maybe we are right now. Maybe we will again. Now this all sounds perhaps rather simple. But of course, it's much more complicated than that. However, the complexities that might arise in our mind as we reason within ourselves and we debate in our own mind whether or not something is lawful, it doesn't have to be that complex. We make it complex. God puts it in black and white. So sin is something that we are familiar with. We know it. We've been there, and it has brought us moments of pleasure, hasn't it? Be honest, it has. If it was not pleasurable, nobody would do that. And so we want it sometimes. Sometimes we want to feel that. Sometimes sinning sounds reasonable. We reason, maybe it's not all that bad. But it's not. Sin is never reasonable, ever. Let's go to Genesis 19, all the way back to the book of Genesis. And so you and I, because we are familiar with sin, we are familiar with our past and the ways of this world, we look back at times, don't we? We look back by looking at the world, by thinking about those things we are familiar with, and it might have an attraction to us. And so we can't do that. Now, this does not mean that we should ever deny the past. Say that never happened, and I don't know that. I don't just cut ourselves off from it entirely and say and act like it never happened. Because recalling past experiences is acknowledging those things that happened as part of the road to recovery. You know, they teach that in AA meetings. Is you have to admit that those things happened, that we participated in those things. And then move on. Learn from our past mistakes and then move on. Now, the danger about this, though, and looking back and remembering those things is the rumination, where we might turn a matter over and over in our mind, and we begin to look back fondly at some of those things that we may have done that were wrong. Now, there's a possible example of the lesson to not look back in this way found in the story of Lot and his family. Lot and his wife and eventual children, they lived in or near a wicked city called Sodom. And we know Lot, he was a nephew of Abraham. He traveled with Abraham out of Ur the Chaldees, and he stayed with Abraham for a long time. Lot knew the ways of God, and as far as we know, practiced them to a degree. Abraham and Lot had been through a lot together, but they mutually decided to part ways. And Abraham, he dwelt in the land of Canaan. Lot went to dwell in the cities of the plain, and it says that he pitched his tent even as far as Sodom. Now, why Lot chose those areas is not known. It could be that he saw, well, there's something that could be gained there. It's a good land. It's well watered. Or maybe he saw that maybe some of that was attractive to him. We don't know. It could have appealed to his senses. He had human nature, tainted human nature, just like you and I do. But there came a point when the sins of Sodom became so great that God had decided something has to be done about this. I am going to intervene. Now, why God chose to intervene is not entirely known. I think part of the reason is an example for us, example for future generations. But it could be that for some reason the sin was becoming so widespread it was going to threaten his timetable or his people eventually that would be brought into the land later. And so God knew that the intervention that he was planning would be upsetting to Abraham because of Lot. Abraham loved Lot. And so God decided he was going to meet with Abraham and he was going to tell him what he would do, so to see how Abraham would react to this. Get Abraham's thoughts even. There's nothing wrong with that. So Abraham reasoned with this individual that appeared to him, which I believe was Christ appearing to him in a human form. And he pleaded for him, if you will, are you going to do this for, 10 righteous? I think he started a higher number and then he went down. And so God knew what Abraham was getting at. And he said, okay. He left and he decided, I'll save Lot. Now, it's not recorded that's what he told Abraham, but that's what God decided to do. I'm going to save Lot and his family, and I'm going to send two angels down there to take them out of harm's way. And so in Genesis 19, we're going to pick up the story here. Verse 1, now two angels came to Sodom in the evening, and Lot was sitting in the gate of Sodom. So it appears that Lot had become a man of status here in that community. He was sitting at the gate, welcoming people, coming and going. And when Lot saw them, he rose to meet them, and he bowed himself with his face toward the ground, and he said, hear now, my lords, please turn into your servant's house and spend the night. Speaking of himself, come stay the night with me and wash your feet, and you may rise early and go on your way. And they said, no, we will spend the night in the open square. But he insisted so strongly, so they turned into him and entered his house. And then he made them a feast, and he baked unleavened bread, and they ate. Now before they lay down, the men of the city, the men of Sodom, both old and young, all the people from every quarter surrounded the house, and they called to Lot and said to him, where are the men who came to you tonight? Bring them out to us that we may know them carnally. So he's talking sexually. It's an indication of the depravity in that city. So Lot went out to them through the doorway, shut the door behind him, and said, please, my brethren, do not do so wickedly. So he was aware that this is a great sin. See, I have two daughters who have not known a man. Please let me bring them out to you, and you may do with them as you wish. Only do nothing to these men, since this is the reason they have come under the shadow of my roof. So it's, I think Lot must have lied about this in the heat of the moment, and we'll see that later as we go forward. And they said, stand back. And then they said, this one came in to stay here, and he keeps acting as a judge. So there's, you know, you're not a native to Sodom. You came to stay here, and now you think you're some big hotshot. You know, you may have some prestige in the community, but who are you to tell us what to do? We're going to do what we want. And so it's, he said, and he keeps acting as a judge, and now we will deal worse with you than with them. And so they pressed hard against the man Lot and came near to break down the door. But the men, speaking of the angels that came and appeared as men, reached out their hands and pulled Lot into the house with them and shut the door. And they struck the men who were at the doorway to the house with blindness, both small and great, so that they became weary trying to find the door. And then the men said to Lot, have you anyone else here? Son-in-law, your sons, your daughters, and whomever you have in the city, take them out of this place. So he's telling them, look, at something terrible is coming. You better get the people, your family, you love, and take them out of here. For we will destroy this place because the outcry against them has grown great before the face of the Eternal. And the Eternal has sent us to destroy it. So Lot went out and spoke to his sons-in-law, who had married his daughters, and said, get up, get out of this place, for the Eternal will destroy this city. But to his sons-in-law, he seemed to be joking. They didn't believe him. So here's part of the lie. You know, previously Lot said that, you know, here's my two daughters. They haven't married, you know, known anyone sexually, but they had, he had sons-in-laws. Perhaps they were betrothed and not married. It's likely that they were already married, but we can't know for certain in that regard. In any case, so he's telling them, you got to get out of here. Take those people that are dear to you and get out. We're going to destroy it. But his sons-in-law, they didn't believe it. He thought, this is a joke. What, is he kidding? And when the morning dawned, the angels urged Lot to hurry, saying, arise, take your wife and your two daughters who are here, lest you be consumed in the punishment of the city. So there's a timeline here. It's coming. It's set. It's declared. We don't have time. You got to move. And then it goes on, and while he lingered, speaking of Lot, he lingered, the men took hold of his hand and his wife's hand and the hands of his two daughters, and the Eternal being merciful to him, they brought him out and set him outside the city. And so Lot, he kept delaying. He lingered. He didn't really want to go. I mean, he had built a life in this city. He was invested in that place now. He had a business. He had friends. He had family. And perhaps maybe he didn't want to leave that lifestyle. He had become accustomed to it. And could it be, in this example for us, that some of us are still lingering? We don't really want to leave. We don't really want to get out of it entirely. When God is saying, it's time to leave. It's time to get out. Leave that way of life behind. Now it also says, in verse 16, that the angels took hold of Lot. They took hold of his hands, also his wife, and his two daughters' hands. And it says that they brought them out. And I quote, set them outside the city. Now the definitions of these terms suggest that Lot did not leave the city under his own power. He was lingering. He was delaying. And in fact, when you look at the account, there's no scripture stating that his family walked or they ran or they passed through the gates of the city in order to escape. And the impression given, therefore, is that Lot and his wife and his children were taken outside of the city. That God supernaturally brought them out of this place and put them in a place of safety. And that's very important when we consider the prophesied future place of safety. And we had written about that prolifically in a book on this subject, which I brought for you that are on the internet to consider. If you have not read this book, I highly recommend reading this book titled A Place of Safety. When, how, and why will God protect his people? Those are answers that questions that can be answered. And the reason it's important for us is because when a minister, there are some groups out there where the ministers are saying, you got to pay attention to us. We'll tell you when it's time to go. Get your things ready. Sell off your property, sell off your goods, and you know, and send the money to us so we can prepare to go, or you better get your plane tickets. No, that's not the case. And there's biblical examples of why that is not the case. The people we should be watching in order to be chosen to go to a place of safety is ourselves. As Christ said, watch you therefore, that you're not caught off guard. Watch yourself, watch your behavior, so that you're found worthy to be taken. In any case, in Genesis 19, in verse 17, after they were taken outside the city, it came to pass when they had brought them outside that one of the angels said, escape for your life. Do not look behind you, nor stay anywhere in the plain. Escape to the mountains, lest you be destroyed. Now, this is a direct command. It came from an angel, but it's as good as coming from God, because God sent these angels down there for this purpose, to take Lot and his family out and to give them instructions on what they were to do. And there is a duality, a dual meaning to this command here, where he said, do not look behind you, do not stay anywhere in the plain. Escape for your life, lest you be destroyed. It's a literal command. But it comes with it a profound implication, doesn't it? It means to not look back at the life you once lived. Do not look back fondly at those things you may have participated in. And that at that environment that I am bringing you out of, don't miss that old way of life. Go forward in faith. If you have a ribbon or a bookmark, put it right here in Genesis 19 and go forward to Luke chapter 17. This meaning, this interpretation of the command is part of the reason why Christ used this example of what not to do. In Luke 17, when speaking of days prior to his second coming, Luke 17 in verse 26, Christ gave this example of what it would be like before he returns. He says, and as it was in the days of Noah, so it will be also in the days of the Son of Man. Now some people say, well look, as soon as the evil gets as bad as it was in the days of Noah, then we know Christ is going to return. And there may be an application to that, I agree. But what Christ was specifically talking about is said in the next verse. They ate, they drank, they married wives, they were given in marriage until the day that Noah entered the ark and the flood came and destroyed them all. In other words, they didn't see anything really different. All things continue as they were. Well, they just continued to do what they always did. But then it came upon them suddenly. Likewise, as it was also in the days of Lot. Another example, they ate, they drank, they bought, they sold, they planted, they built. But on the day that Lot went out of Sodom, it rained fire and brimstone from heaven and destroyed them all. And even so will it be in the day when the Son of Man is revealed, meaning when he makes himself known to everyone. And that day, he who is on the housetop and his goods are in the house, let him not come down to take them away. And likewise, the one who is in the field, let him not turn back don't go back for anything. Why? Because you're going to be taken, and there's no reason to look back for those things. You don't need any of that. What you need should have been gained before I come. The character, that's what you need. And then he gives the example here in verse 32. Remember Lot's wife. A striking illustration. Whoever seeks to save his life in this world, that is, to enjoy this, what can be enjoyed in this world, well, you're going to lose it. And whoever will lose his life, that is, give up the things of this world, well, you're going to preserve your life. Those things that are ungodly, those things that you might want to experience, but God says, no, don't do it. Don't look back. It's time to leave. I tell you, he said, in that night, there will be two men in one bed, and the one will be taken, and the other will be left. Two women will be grinding together. The one will be taken and the other left. Two men will be in the field and the one will be taken and the other left. Taken. They're not walking. They're being taken. And they answered and said to him, where, Lord? So he said to them, wherever the body is, there the eagles would be gathered together. And it's our belief Christ was talking about himself. Part of the reason for a place of safety. Why a place of safety? It's, well, to keep people safe, that's one of the reasons. But another reason is to be further instructed personally by the Lord. Wherever the Lord, he said, the body's there. The eagles are going to be gathered. He's going to take people. Just like he took Lot and his family out of Sodom before it was destroyed. So the moral of these instructions is to not turn back. Don't look back to those things that we might be doing beforehand. I mean, we're called to come out of this world. We're called to come out of the Babylonian mysteries and the sin that is found in it. And we're given in specific instructions of what we should do. And part of those instructions is the instruction is denying those things that are ungodly and unrighteous and evil and not looking back. And even if, you know, think about this. Even if we're not in the thick of it, we might be not there participating with everybody in all of their revelries, but sitting on the fence, enjoying the spectacle. I'm gonna take this in. I'm just gonna enjoy the atmosphere of this. It's likened to what he said not to do. Don't dwell in the plains of Sodom. Don't sit in the wings and go, oh, I'm just gonna be out here just kind of, you know, enjoying what's going on over there. Lot and his family were told, don't do this, leave. It's time to get out and leave. And we are told what? Come out of her, my people, lest you partake of her sins and be subject to her plagues. The example's right there. Let's go back to Genesis in chapter 19. So after Lot and his family were taken out of harm's way, they were told to go forward. They were told, don't turn around, don't look back. If they did turn around, it wouldn't go well for them. They weren't told exactly what would happen. At least we don't have that in print. They were just told, don't do it. And what a striking image that brings, you know. Revelation 18:4 says, come out of her, my people, lest you partake of her sins and experience her plagues. And that's what would happen if Lot or any of his family members looked back. They would receive of the same type of plague. And so what happened next? Well, let's continue. Genesis 19 and verse 18, Lot said to these two individuals, please know, my lords. He didn't want to go to the mountains. He was afraid. Indeed, your servant has found favor in your sight, and you have increased your mercy, which you have shown to me by saving my life, but I cannot escape to the mountains, lest some evil overtake me and I die. So some people think that he didn't want to go to the mountains because it was, maybe he thought it was still too close to Sodom, or some people think maybe he was afraid of wild animals, or perhaps there were people that lived in the mountains he was afraid of. In any case, Lot introduces an alternative plan here. He says, see now, this city is near enough to flee, and it's a little one. You know, it's just a little humble little city. Please let me escape there. Isn't it a little one? And my soul shall live. And he said to Lot, see, I have favored you concerning this thing also in that which I will not overthrow this city, this little city for which you have spoken. Hurry, escape there, for I cannot do anything until you arrive there. And therefore the name of the city was called Zoar. So the sun had risen upon the earth when Lot entered Zoar. And the Eternal then rained brimstone and fire on Sodom and Gomorrah from the Eternal out of the heavens. He overthrew those cities, all on the plain, and all the inhabitants of the cities, and what grew on the ground. But what with his wife, speaking of Lot's wife, she looked back behind him, and she became a pillar of salt. That's a terrible thing and an interesting thing. Now, they were told to not look back. And Lot's wife, although her name is not known, well, we just refer to her as Lot's wife. There is a Jewish tradition that where she is named Adu or Edith, but that's can't be verified. Another interesting thing about Lot's wife is exactly who she was or where she came from, or, you know, was she a good woman? Was she faithful to Lot? Maybe was she an adulteress? We don't know. Did she revere God? Well, we assume that she revered God because of Lot. I mean, he was the head of his household and a God-fearing individual to a degree, as far as we know, although, you know, some have their doubts about how good of a person Lot was. He is called righteous Lot later in the scriptures. But what was going on in her mind when she turned back? We don't really know. We can make an educated guess about this, but it's not certain exactly what she was thinking. And there could be a few things that she was thinking when she looked back. Maybe she was just curious. She just wanted, what's it, you know, this sounds terrible. What's that look like? What's really going on back there? Maybe she was sympathetic or had a degree of empathy for people that were there. You know, those were people, many of them may have been her friends or her neighbors. Maybe she wondered about her sons-in-law that were left behind. Are they trailing? Are they coming? Is there anybody escaping? And of course, she may have longed for that place. She may have missed it already. It became a part of her life, and maybe she didn't want to leave that lifestyle. She wished it would continue. I want to go back and stay there. That's my home. I like that. Luke chapter 9. Well, to any of these possible things that she may have been thinking, none of them justify what she did. I mean, the old adage, curiosity killed the cat, that could apply here if she was just curious about what it looked like. So being curious about something that is dangerous, that we know is dangerous, and in this case, God tells you, don't do that. You know, that's brought people harm in multiple ways, some to the point of death. Now, being sympathetic for those people in the city of Sodom and in the plain and those other cities, that, you know, sympathy is not a sin. But, you know, the people, they had it coming. And the sadness shouldn't be dwelt upon. But you can't really blame somebody for having a moment of sadness or grief for this, you know, being aware of, sometimes witnessing the sorrow of others. It gets you in the heart. Longing to be back in that place, of course, that's a problem. That's a big problem. You know, it's contrary to the attitude that God hopes for us to have, then it's that contrary to what God desired for Lot and his family to have, the attitude and the mindset he wanted them to have. And so this is the same as a warning. Come out. Come out of that way. Come out over my people and go forward in faith. So you and I have chosen to live God's way of life, but how committed are we to that way of life? Is it possible that we look back at the ways of this world and we think, oh, that's kind of attractive. I want to do that some more. I want to be in that some more. I want to experience that. Regardless of what Lot's wife was thinking, the scriptures are not entirely clear what she was thinking, but they are clear about several things. And it is this: God has told us to come out of this world. He has told us to walk in the newness of life. Now, are we doing that? Are we coming out of this world and walking in the way? We've talked about that recently. The way of God, the way of Christ. Do we have a straight and narrow path? Or are we trying to make our path broaden it, you know, make it a little wide, more flexible? We want to be more flexible like people of the world. In Luke 9 and verse 59, Christ here is talking to some disciples and calling some disciples even. And he said to another, follow me. And he said, well, Lord, let me go first and bury my father. And Jesus said to him, well, let the dead bury the dead. But you go and preach the kingdom of God. In other words, there's an urgent message here. It's time to move. And it's an urgent message for us. We can't keep putting it off. It's time to do something right now. And another also said in verse 61, Lord, I will follow you, but let me first go and bid them farewell who are at my house. But Jesus said to him, no one having his hand to the plow and looking back is fit for the kingdom of God. So this is directly related to what Lot's wife may have been thinking. You know, did she look back with a desire to be a part of that wicked environment? She liked it. She enjoyed it. Maybe she did look back for sadness' sake, that she had remorse for those people. Now, the scriptures, even though they're not clear, one thing they are clear in telling us is that the instructions are to wait on the Lord. In other words, to be faithful to the Lord. He is the one who can deliver us. We can't deliver ourselves. We need him in this way. We have to endure in this way. Now, we have no record of Lot's wife as far as her past history, where she came from. We don't know if she was a virtuous woman, or perhaps maybe she was not faithful. Lot, we do see that he wanted to stay in that environment, that he delayed, lingered. And he actually wanted to go there in the first place. Why? We don't know. I think it's probably likely for profit. He saw some kind of benefit as far as business goes. But he could have left long before the threat of destruction came. I mean, but it's kind of like you could consider him a frog in the pot. He just stayed in the environment. And he just accepted a little more, a little more, a little more, and just kept going along with it. Whatever the reason, Lot's wife turned around to see the fire and the brimstone burning in the distance. However, if you go back to Genesis 19, Abraham saw the same thing. When he looked, got up in the morning and looked in the distance, of course he was more further away. But something I think when we don't consider, when we're trying to figure out what was she thinking, what was Lot's wife thinking, something we may not consider is it doesn't really matter. exactly what she was thinking, whether it was I'm just curious or I feel sad for those people. I want to see if my sons-in-law are coming. It doesn't really matter. The point is God said, don't look behind you. It's pretty simple. Straightforward. This was not negotiable. Don't look behind you unless you're kind of curious or if you're looking for your son-in-law. No, she said, don't do it. Some have also wondered why God chose to kill her in this way by turning her to a pillar of salt. Now, there's a Jewish tradition for this, that the Jewish tradition is that Lot asked for his wife to bring salt for the meal that was to be enjoyed by the two angels who appeared as men and that were visiting in their home. And she was somewhat rebellious in this request, that she scoffed and that she went off to, they didn't have any salt, so she went off to get some from her neighbors, and they asked, well, what do you want salt for? And well, there's some visitors, we have company, and you know, my husband, he's just a jerk, and he wants me to do this and that. And then because she did this, the visitors went, oh, fresh meat. Let's go. Let's get them. And that she actually had a part to play in the crowd that gathered. Now, I don't believe that that is the case. But that is an old Jewish tradition. It doesn't match the scriptures. On the other hand, the reason why she may have been turned to salt could be that salt is what we know as a preservative. That it's preserved something for a long period of time. And so it could be that the substance was chosen to relate the fact that this is an enduring lesson. It's a lesson unto the end and even beyond. Come out of her, my people. Do not look back, lest you receive of her plagues. And that's what she did. She looked back, and she received the same type of punishment that people in Sodom and Gomorrah and other locations received. Some think that the pillar, that is what is left of Lot's wife, actually still stands today. There is an unusual rock formation that's north of the Dead Sea in the area of Jordan, and some say that this is what's left of Lot's wife. In fact, the location has been called Lot's wife, and there's a cave nearby, interestingly, that's called Lot's Cave. Now, I used that image, for those people that are tuning in electronically, I used that image on the internet before the live stream. You probably saw it, but this doesn't mean I believe that that's what's left of Lot's wife. I actually think it's probably not what's left. I mean, it does stand unusually upright up on a little mount, which is interesting, but it's larger than the size of a human being, and it doesn't really have the shape of a human with its legs coming down. It kind of goes wider at the base, and some might say, oh, that was her flowing garments as they all turned to salt. You know, I think it's a stretch, but it could be that these two locations, after they received the names Lot's wife and Lot's cave, because, oh, that's interesting, and oh, there's a cave over here, and they put two and two together, and it just kind of stuck, and some people latched onto it and said, ah, that's what it is. But so the tale of that location is legendary. But we know the story of Lot and his wife is not a legend. It's not myth. It's not fable. It happened. Lot's wife was cursed unto death, and her story endures as a lesson for us today. It's preserved as an enduring principle in more than one way. And one of them is, when God says, don't do it, don't do it. Don't reason among in our own mind, oh, that's fine. Well, wait a minute, maybe you didn't mean exactly not to do it. Maybe you just meant don't do it wholeheartedly. Maybe if I just do it a little bit, that'll be okay. No, it's not. I also found it interesting that Abraham, he looked toward Sodom, and he didn't turn to a pillar of salt. In Genesis 19, in verse 27, Abraham went early in the morning to the place where he had stood before the Eternal, and he looked toward Sodom and Gomorrah and toward all the land of the plain. And he saw, and behold, the smoke of the land which went up like the smoke of a furnace. And it came to pass when God destroyed the cities of the plain that God remembered Abraham and sent Lot out of the midst of the overthrow. And he overthrew the cities in which Lot had dwelt. So Abraham, he did not receive this curse that Lot's wife did. Now, on the one hand, you could say, well, Abraham was not looking back. He didn't come out of that location. He was already out of that location, so he wasn't turning around and looking back. He did look in the direction, of course, but also there's this. See, Abraham was not given the same directives in regards to leaving that location. He had already come out of her. He had already said, I'm not going over there. I'm not going to be a part of that. You can do that, Lot, but I'm not going there. I'm staying here. So Abraham had the same kind of moral standards that were to be kept as Lot and his family, or by Lot and his family. They were to have the same ethic. 1 Chronicles 13, now, some might think that if Lot's wife was turning around just to see what was going on, that, you know, this isn't really worthy of such a harsh punishment, is it? She was just curious. She just felt bad for those people. But that, of course, is missing the entire point. You see, when God says, don't look back, that's the point. Don't do it. It's a simple command. And as the principle goes, those who are unfaithful in the least, which is a very simple command, don't do it, those will be unfaithful in much. Another example of what some might consider to be an innocent blunder, if you will, is the death of Uzzah. The Ark of the Covenant was captured by the Philistines, and the Philistines had kept it for 7 months. And these Gentiles, they experienced many horrible things supernaturally, curses as a result of hanging on to the Ark. And so they decided that we're going to send it back. We got to get that out of here. The Ark was sent, and it was received in Beth Shemesh. The people of that area were ecstatic about receiving the Ark of the Covenant back. And it was afterward moved to the house of Abinadab, where it remained in that location for some 20 years before David decided to bring it out. Now, there was nothing wrong with David wanting to move the Ark to a more suitable, a more honorable, perhaps, location. However, there is a protocol for transporting the Ark. And we see the instructions in part in Exodus 25, where it relates that rings were to be made for the Ark, and then poles of acacia wood that were to be covered in gold, and those were to be placed into the rings, and the Ark was to be transported in this way. In other words, don't touch it. Nobody was to touch the Ark. The only individuals that could touch the Ark, and only for specific reasons, were sons of Aaron, Levitical priests of the temple, the tabernacle, and then later the temple. In Numbers 4 and verse 15 says that when Aaron and his sons have finished covering the sanctuary and all the furnishings of the sanctuary, and this includes the Ark of the Covenant, when the camp is set to go, in other words, we're going to transport these things, then the sons of Kohath, which were Levites, not sons of Aaron, but they were sons of Kohath, Levites nonetheless, they shall come to carry them. And it says, but they shall not touch any holy thing, lest they die. There's the command. Don't touch it. Carry it with the poles. That's how you do it. Now, when the Ark was returned by the Philistines to Beth Shemesh, or Shemeth, the people were so excited that they made offerings, and they put the ark on display. And people traveled from the whole area there to come and to see the ark. Now, many of the people were overly zealous. So this means not zealous in a positive way. They were so excited that they were smitten. And the reason is they looked into the ark. They touched it. God said, don't do this. So the excitement of having the ark in their midst, that was not a sin. The sin was a violation of a simple command. Don't touch it. So there's never a good reason, you see? There's never a good reason to violate a direct command of God, no matter how innocent it might seem on our behalf. And this is similar to the example of Lot's wife. And then also, as we're going to read, that during the transportation of the ark, when David had brought it out from, Kirjath-Jearim, it was in this location for some 20 years, and in 1 Chronicles 13, in verse 5, it says, so David gathered all Israel together from Shihor to Egypt, to as far as the entrance of Hamath, to bring the ark of God from Kirjath-Jearim. And David and all Israel went up to Baalah, to Kirjath-Jearim, which belonged to Judah, to bring up from there the ark of God the Eternal, who dwells between the cherubim, where his name is proclaimed. So they carried the ark of God on a new cart from the house of Abinadab, and Uzzah and Ahio drove the cart. Then David and all Israel played music before God with all their might, with singing on harps and on stringed instruments and tambourines and cymbals and trumpets. It was joyous. It was wonderful. It must have been just a really neat thing to see, and the zeal of the people of, look, God, he's coming back to be with his people once again. That's what was being portrayed here. And when they came to Kidon's threshing floor, Uzzah put out his hand to hold the ark, for the oxen stumbled. So you might think, oh, well, they stumbled, and oh, it's rocking a little bit. He put it out his hand to keep it. Maybe he thought it was going to fall off the cart. Then the anger of the Eternal was aroused against Uzzah, and he struck him because he put his hand to the ark, and he died there before God. Whoa. All of the music and the joy and the singing came to a halt at that point. And David became angry because of the Eternal's outbreak against Uzzah, and therefore the place is called Perez Uzzah to this day. And David was afraid of God that day, saying, how can I bring the ark of God to me? And so the reason David was afraid is because this wasn't well thought out. You know, the road to hell, as we've heard the expression, is paved with good intentions. And David had good intentions. And it seemed to be going pretty well. But everybody was not, you know, in line with what God said, here's what you do. Here's how you do it. Don't touch it. So regardless of what we might think is a good reason to violate one of God's commands, no matter how trivial we might think it is, it's presumptuous. Don't do it. You know, to think that we know better than God in any shape or form is actually a violation, a direct violation of the first commandment. Don't have any other gods, but we think we know better? Oh, you're God now? Are we God? No. But that's what people are doing today. People are walking around thinking they're a bunch of little gods. I'm going to decide for myself. It has cost people their lives, and it will cost more lives. And we have the example of it cost Lot's wife her life. And it cost Uzzah his wife, because they didn't follow the command. Lot's wife looked back when she was told not to. Uzzah reached out and touched the ark. They said, don't touch it. Philippians 3, and we're going to end over there. we should never, ever think that it's okay to violate a command of God. So ask ourselves, do we do this in any way? Do we consider any of our lies to be white? That's kind of an ironic expression, isn't it? A white lie. Oh, it's innocent. It's just, they mean good. It's never good to lie. Don't do it. Do we think that some of God's instructions are flexible? That we don't have to do all of them? We can pick and choose what we want to do? Are there sins that we might have that we try to justify and think it's okay because of my situation? Have we put our hand to the plow and yet we look back sometimes? Maybe we look back longing for the ways of this world. Not all of them. I just want a few, God. I just want a few of these ways. He said, don't do it. It's never a good thing to go contrary to what God's instructions in any shape or form. And we can't justify sin. You know, if God says don't touch it, we don't touch it. If he says don't look back, don't look back. If God says to do it, this is what you need to do, it's non-negotiable. We don't get to say, well, maybe if he just meant a little bit. Maybe if I take a few steps when God says, no, I want you to go all the way. You'll meet me halfway, God. You're merciful, right? You're loving. You can meet me halfway, right? It's compromise. It's sin. We don't want to do that. So no matter what we might think, God's commands are right here for us. They're right here in black and white. We can read them. We are literate. And we might weaken at times. I'm not saying we're justified in doing it, but we might. I want to encourage us, because sometimes we do become weak. Sometimes we might sin. But we can repent. We can change. And we cannot repeat those things and say, I'm not going to do that anymore. We can, in this way, we're not looking back. Instead, go forward. Go forward in faith. There was an individual by the name of Thomas Carlyle, and this individual spent 2 years of his life documenting the history of the French Revolution, and he gave this copy, which he only had a single manuscript, he gave it to a colleague by the name of John Stuart Mill, and he wanted Mill to read it and to critique the document. Tragically, Mill's servant had used Carlyle's manuscript as kindling for a fire, probably more than one fire. And Mill had to relate this news to Carlyle, and as he told him what had happened, Carlyle's countenance fell. It was said that his face even became pale, and he fell into a deep depression because of this. He had spent 2 years of his life, thousands of hours, lonely hours spent writing, and he seemed like it's all wasted, all for nothing. But then one day, while he was walking the streets, Carlyle became transfixed as he saw this tall brick wall being built, and he watched as this magnificent wall was being raised. One brick at a time. One brick, then another brick, then another brick. And he thought, this became an illustration to him. He said, you know, if I write, he said to himself, if I write one page a day, I can rewrite the book. And so he did. One day at a time. One week at a time. One month at a time. And eventually he completed the work. Philippians 3 and verse 12, Paul tells us to go forward and to press toward this goal. And Paul, as wise as he was, understood that he hadn't attained yet. That there's still an opportunity for him to miss the mark. And this is a qualification process that you and I are going through. And so in verse 12, he said, not that I have already attained or I'm already perfected, but I press on that I may lay hold of that for which Christ has also laid hold of me. Brethren, I do not count myself to have apprehended. But one thing I do, forgetting those things which are behind. In other words, don't dwell on the past. It doesn't mean don't act like they never happened. Learn from our mistakes. But don't look back fondly. Forget those things that are behind. Leave them behind. And reach forward to those things which are ahead. We have a goal. We have a purpose in life. Reach toward those things. Go forward. I press toward, in verse 14, I press toward the goal for the prize of the upward call of God in Christ Jesus. Now, it's interesting that this translation I'm reading, the New King James translation, says that I press toward the goal. Some translations, such as the King James, says I press toward the mark. And I kind of like that better. And the reason why is this. You see, the term that's translated as mark, and in my translation it's translated as goal, is a Greek word, skopos. And it's only used in this one place in the Bible. And actually, the professionals in words and in language, they are not exactly sure what this word means. They have some pretty good ideas, but they're not exactly sure. And what I did read is that this term is used through the idea of concealment. In other words, being sealed. And those who are going to be chosen? Those who are sealed by God. And it's also compared to the word skepasmo, which means a noticeable covering, clothing, or raiment. So what Paul, I think, was relating here is I press toward the mark, the clothing, the white righteous garments. I press toward the standard that God has, that he desires for us to have, so that I can qualify, that I can be chosen. Because we have that opportunity. We all have that opportunity. And in the process, you and I, we might have some setbacks in life. But don't get discouraged. Maybe we had some setbacks recently. But it doesn't matter. See, what matters is what we do from here going forward. What we did yesterday is not that important. We can repent. We can change. We don't have to keep dwelling on the past. Forget those things. Leave those things behind. Don't look back. Don't go back toward them. The past is history. We can go forward and we can do it one step at a time, one brick at a time, one day at a time, one week, one month, a year at a time. And we can achieve our goals. So this is what matters, and this is the lesson from Lot's wife. Remember her. Press toward the mark. Press toward the standard that will ensure our place and our position in the kingdom of God.